My name is Charlie. I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to be here tonight. Grateful to be sober. And at a meeting that I'm thrilled to say is a solution-based meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. People coming at this directly from our text, from our big book, coming at this problem, our common problem, with our common solution. And doing it unflinchingly or unwaveringly. And they've been doing it for a while up here. So it's a real honor to be at the podium in a group such as this who takes our recovery, our collective recovery, and our individual recovery so seriously. And there's a lot of laughter and a lot of good times with it, but this is one of those pockets of enthusiasm that was there before that term became fashionable to spread around about meetings. And it's good. I'm very happy to be here, very thrilled to be here. My home group is a Vision for You group. We meet Thursday nights in Union, New Jersey, on Salem Road at Townley Presbyterian Church. And we've also been able to engage in a kind of a partnership with you folks at Bernardsville, and in a little bit of a way that they used to have something like that with Berkeley Heights, and you guys, a little bit, almost a friendly rivalry, but at least a common ground. A lot of you folks have come to Union and spoken, and a lot of us have been able to come up here and do the deal, so it's been a lot of fun. And just to echo what's been said, that truly is the motherload of speaker CDs in that kitchen right now. It is just amazing. I mean, most of them are MP3s, which is about 7 discs worth of material on one CD. There's DVDs, and yeah, please be generous with the hat if you take something, but please take something. And I want to thank Chris for just for doing that, just for taking the effort to do that. A lot like Barefoot Bill, who I'm also pleased to call a friend of mine, tireless in their support of our fellowship, tireless in their service to what we do, and getting this message out. All different. If there's not one speaker there that'll speak to you, there may be 10 speakers that will speak to you. But it's all out there, and it's all good, and it's all coming right from the book, and it's not a scattershot of this, that, and the other thing. It's, if you don't recognize the name, you'll recognize the message. And there's a lot of neat stuff out there to be had, and please do avail yourself of it, and commend Chris and this group for the generosity of spirit they show in doing something like that just for free. I mean, it tributes cookies, you know, tributes some Chips Ahoy out on a table. So at least we can get well with stuff like this. I have a sponsor, and I sponsor people. My anniversary date, my sobriety date, is April 6th, 1998. I was separated from alcohol for the one and only time. At one time, I was introduced at the podium as a first-time winner, and I had never been called that before. And I kind of bristled a little bit because the insinuation is that might make someone else a loser. But it's only by the grace of God that has transpired. I quit once and once only. I don't have a message of hope. Well, I do have a message of hope, but my experience is with one time being able to put this stuff down and walk away from it. And I am so grateful to the power of a caring, loving God that is my story and that is my history. And I'm so grateful to the members of this fellowship that ensured that was my story and that was my history. And extremely good sponsorship and a lot of wonderful teachers in my life have made that the case. If that's not your story, we trudge this happy road together, shoulder to shoulder. There's not winners and losers here. You're here tonight. We all have our common ground of recovery and our common ground of experience. So we want to celebrate that for sure tonight. I was here. I got into a little trouble here a couple Saturdays ago. I know that's a different meeting, but it's the same room. And I got a little, you know, talk about whatever you want. And I said, all right. And I brought in a message of, just kind of came to me, of problems other than alcoholism, but from the point of view of the alcoholic and from the point of view of our text. I took a little beating, you know, that day, and it was okay. Nobody got killed, you know, before or after or during the meeting. And little flack, and got around. I don't know. I did what God sent me to do, and I thought I did the best I could at it. And it wasn't long until Chris says, "We got to get you up here on a Tuesday," you know. So as soon as he found that I got in a little hot water, he wanted to make sure he got me up here while I was still in that mode. And I've been really blessed with getting to speak in a lot of different places in a very short period of time. And it seems to be my pattern that's the path that God sets out for me. If I waver in one area of my life, or if I struggle in certain areas, I seem to be invited to speak a lot when inside of me I want to say, no, I'm not that guy, or no, I can't, or I feel less than. But God encourages me and gives me strength to go out there and share only my current experience, strength, and hope, and that's all I can bring to the podium. And every day is not perfect, and every day is not a pink cloud, but every day is another day that we get to walk in this life and certainly in this way of living. A bunch of guys from my home group came out tonight, and a bunch of them are sitting right in the front row, so I won't get away with too much tonight. At least in the Muppets, they put those two guys way up in the balcony. Right here, I got them right in the front row. So I just want to, again, I want to thank Chris for asking me, and I want to thank the group for being so warm and hospitable to this message. Talk a little bit about how I got here, how I got to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, what brought me here, and a lot of the things that happened since I got here. And I've been blessed, you know, with the grace of God, I've been blessed with this solution, but the solution didn't come to me early on when I got here. I struggled for a while with the only instructions that I was capable of hearing at the time. I don't know whether other instructions were given, but I struggled with a few basic instructions, and I didn't really get this message for about 3.5 years in the fellowship. But once I got the message, it certainly took hold, and I was able to look at this book, which I had read with extreme disinterest on my own, and I couldn't identify at all with what was being said in the opening pages. I skipped over the doctor's opinion because I wasn't sick. That proved to be false, and I moved right to the story about the stockbroker in World War I, and that didn't offer me too much, and before long I was just flipping through finding many more reasons to disidentify, to disassociate myself with this material, so I put it on the side. It wasn't so many years later that I was brought through this book with an informed teacher, and the words came alive, and many people have shared it many different times. It was like I was reading it for the first time, and many times I'll pick it up and have a new experience with this book, and I'll be reading it for the first time. And that's what this book, that's why this book is probably divinely inspired. That's my opinion. But it speaks to me in a way that tonight I have the blessing of, when I speak about my drinking history, I'll be able to speak of it in terms of the big book. I'll be able to speak of it in terms of Bill's story and the doctor's opinion. Not because I had that revelation then, because I had that revelation now, and I could see the truth about the way I drank, which I could never see before. So I'll talk about drinking because I like the effect, but at the time I was drinking, I was convinced that I only liked the taste, for example. But I don't want to jump too far ahead. I've been having some really neat current experiences with these steps. We've been using a format called Big Book Awakenings, and I've had the distinct pleasure of listening to this gentleman called Joe Hawk for the very first time and having a really new experience with that. And if you've heard Joe before on tapes, maybe you know what I'm talking about, and if you haven't, you'll probably hear a little bit of it tonight, because it is my current experience with this stuff, and it's really some seminal recordings that were made a long time ago, but it really takes you back to chapter and verse of this stuff, and I'm thrilled to be able to have that experience. In addition, being able to give it away through sponsorship, through working with new people at my home group and elsewhere. So you're kind of caught in a crossfire. You know, I work with more experienced people, and the message comes down, trickles down, and I have new experiences with this literature. I have new experiences with the traditions and the concepts, the 24 other spiritual principles that surround this program, and I also have the distinct pleasure to give it away. And I keep what I have, and I strengthen what I have by giving it away. Because although I think the teachers are upline and the students are down below, many, many times the young guy or the new guy will become my teacher in very short order, in a series of questions or even a look. And if I have to explain something or ask me something. So the teachers and students, sometimes we get mixed up and confused, but for me, I need to keep myself in between the more informed and the beginners. This way I'm in a perfect position to learn and to grow and also to give it away. But I wasn't always in a perfect position in my life. I was a victim as a child of what we commonly call a broken home. And I say victim, it was just my circumstance. It was how I was brought up. I was a young boy, and I was being raised by an alcoholic parent, and I certainly have the genetic disposition to this disease. A lot of people will talk about the genetics, you know, could we possibly have this disease through heredity? And the smart aleck answer to that is, sure, my family makes me drink. But the truth of it was, I think I was almost bred for this disease. I'm a big horse racing fan. I'm also a compulsive gambler in addition to being an alcoholic. And I used to study breeding lines for horses. And if you studied my breeding line, you know how I got here tonight. My dad was an inveterate, he was a gambler. I can't say what kind of a gambler he was. He was an impulsive tinkerer and inventor and what we commonly call a ne'er-do-well in the trade. And my mother was one of us. She had this disease and she had problems with prescription medicine. So all the whatever genetic predisposition was there. And when you're raised in an alcoholic household, in addition to the nature of an alcoholic, you're also nurtured in an alcoholic lifestyle. I learned my coping skills from my mom at an early age, and I was able to disassociate with reality at an early age. But this was how I was brought up, and I was brought up in the surroundings of, you know, an alcoholic household. Like Peter M. says many times, the house itself is sick. The family itself is ill. The family suffers from this disease. I mean, long before I would cause the tornado, in others' lives, I'm in the tornado. I'm in a tornado with me and my mom are in a tornado at home. And I looked around, and I saw myself through, I saw myself through the eyes of unreality for the very first time. I was constantly comparing myself to what I would imagine or presuppose was what was going on in reality. I was very enamored of, or almost addicted to TV. And in other fellowship, they talk about your drug of choice, and my drug of choice early on was television. And I was a loner, I would isolate, and it sounds, you know, embarrassing to even say, but I was so happy when the new edition of TV Guide came out. And I could plan. How weird is that, you know? But I would plan my whole week about, you know, having to be here for this and that, and I sat real close and I got absorbed in television, and it took me from reality, and I didn't see what was happening back here, but I became very possessed, and I fell in love with this fantasy world and this little small black and white TV, and which would later be a color TV. But I was watching shows. I'm of a certain age, and maybe some of us are too. I was watching shows like Leave It to Beaver and Father Knows Best. And most of the shows that I watched had a perfectly structured Hollywood type of household and a perfectly structured Hollywood type of street with a perfectly structured, well-manicured lawn, shiny car in the driveway. And when I did have occasion to look around in my reality, I wasn't seeing that. And as a young person, who was to blame? Well, I started to blame myself. I looked around and I didn't see that. My mom didn't do the housework and a string of pearls and a dress like Beaver's mom did. I didn't come home and get my head chuckled and say, "Hey kid, hey son, how was your day?" Or, "Hey Skip, let's go out in the driveway and have a catch." My dad got on a plane, he went on a business trip to Chicago and he didn't return. So, and my mom spent a lot of time trying to poison me against my father. And in turn, I became poisoned against my mother and enamored of my father. I liked what I didn't have and I didn't like what I would have. Early patterns of alcoholism. So it was kind of a sick and twisted upbringing, but it was my upbringing, and I can't disown that. But again, I was always comparing what I was seeing on TV to what I was experiencing, and I became convinced that I was the only person that was living like this. I was the only person that had a lifestyle like I did. I thought everybody I saw out there lived on Beaver Street, you know, like Whitey and Lumpy and all those guys, and everybody was like that. Only the old guys will laugh, but everybody was like that, and I was like this. And so I felt very less than and very inferior, and I felt very like impoverished or like I didn't have enough. I had this really massive inferiority complex, and I was able to do well enough in school academically that I went to school with what you would call another class of guys. I went to a Catholic high school in Staten Island, and it was my first time really mixing out of my immediate community. So I knew that nobody knew how I was brought up and how I was raised, but I felt that they would find out in very short order. So I was living in a lot of fear. I was experiencing a lot of fear. These guys had a lot of things I didn't have. They got cars for their birthday. You know, I was lucky if I got a picture of a car for my birthday. You know, they would drive up to school in a spanking new car that someone, that mom bought them at 16, you know. And I didn't have that. And I was standing waiting for the bus. And, you know, I didn't know. These guys went to swim clubs. I didn't know what a swim club was. You know, they had private swim clubs out where they lived. And I didn't know that. All I knew was the public pool. You know, down in Tompkinsville in Staten Island. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but as many people would fit in that pool, and one person would pop out and another person would hop right in, and you'd all just jump around and together because you were that close. And it was just, you know, it was cool. It was fun. It was all we knew, but it was, you know, it wasn't a swim club. Let's put it that way. So again, I'm in this cycle of inferiority and feeling less than and really at this ease with my home situation. And I tell you one thing, growing up like that, It's not a recipe for success. It's not a recipe for sound mental functioning. You know, I hated my mom for leaving. I hated my dad for leaving. I hated my mom for staying. And holidays were mixed up, confused events in my life. There wasn't something I looked forward to. I would look forward to getting them behind me. So I was at a dichotomy. I was at a distance from normal society. And I'm at this high school, this kind of a semi-affluent high school, and I'm feeling the same you know, dis-ease and discomfort. Book talks about restless, irritable, and discontent. You know, restless for sure, irritable all the time, and discontent with what I had, wanting what you had so bad, thinking that if I had what you had, everything would be okay. If I had got a new car at 16, I would be okay. If I could go to a swim club, I would be okay. If I could get things, I would be okay. If I had nicer clothes, then I would be okay. And it wasn't long before I started to associate external things were going to fix my internal reality. And so into this maelstrom of inferiority, fear, raging adolescence, and again with the temper of the times of the 60s and the early 70s, where we don't have a situation of just say no, or it was more, you introduce alcohol into this mix. And like a mad scientist making a solution into that, you poured alcohol and watch what happened, and what happened was me, a raging alcoholic, right from the get-go. The book talks about perhaps that we were normal drinkers, moderate drinkers, then we became hard drinkers, and then perhaps we became full-blown alcoholics. Mentions that a couple times. And that's not my experience. You know, alcohol had me from the get-go. Alcohol had me from hello. It really had me, and it had me in its grip very early on and very severely. I didn't see it as such. I didn't realize it as such, but it started to do for me what I could not do for myself. And if I look back on my early stages of my drinking, I can see certain patterns of association with alcohol that we're gonna predict what the next 24 years would be like. We're going to predict what my life would be like for the next 28 years, I guess, from the age of 16 to the age of 44 when I finally put down a drink. But, you know, 28 years of unremitting alcohol, and then when alcohol wasn't enough, I used other substances, and when those substances weren't enough, I engaged in other behaviors, and I continued to engage in other behaviors even after my sobriety date, because I was desperate not to change my sobriety date, and I engaged in a lot of substitution. But I ran a whole gamut of offenses, conference and non-conference approved, that's for sure. Well, one thing wouldn't do, the other would, and what the combination wouldn't do, the third would, and that's how I kind of lived my life. And I was, really, right from the get-go, we drank to get the effect. We knew right away what choices we were making, because I remember the very first night buying alcohol, and we were going to buy Colt 45. One of my buddies, who was an older brother, was accomplished drinker, and told us what deli would serve us. You know, God, we must have looked like school kids, but we went in there, and the guy looked the other way. It had all these dried fish and thing hanging from the ceiling. It was kind of a weird place on Staten Island, but they would serve us beer. We knew that, and we knew to go there. And there's beer, and then there's Colt 45, and we knew the Colt 45 was a little stronger, so we opted for that, and the Colt 45 came in two sizes. So we got the bigger size. So from the very first night, I'm already drinking the bigger and the stronger of all the options presented to me at Aristo's Deli, I think it was called. So I'm right to the top shelf, and as far as I could go in that deli, that's where I am already from the start. And that was a picture or a foreshadowing of what the next 28 years was going to be like. Stronger and more. Bigger and better. How much can you carry? How much can you consume? The last guy standing was the winner. And it was all that kind of mentality. So we go up into Goodyear Woods, and we're drinking. We pop open a Colt 45, and I had never really had a beer before. I remember some mad panic in my house when I drank a big glass of wine, thinking it was grape juice, and everybody had this. Everybody got real excited that I drank the wine. I remember that, and I think I remember feeling the excitement. I certainly didn't feel it. I certainly don't remember feeling the wine or anything like that. But I remember being the center of attention for a very short minute or two, and I thought that was kind of cool. And then we were going out to the ice follies or something, seeing something with my family or something like that. I remember falling in love with the lead skater, and that was kind of neat. So it wasn't the first time, it wasn't the last time that would happen to me, when I would leave the house and fall in love with the first woman I saw. But we're drinking the stronger, and we're drinking the Colt 45, and I tell you, I wasn't too enamored of the taste. I didn't really care for the taste too much. I had kind of a vaguely, like, I don't know, tastes like grainish mush or something with a little effervescence and not too much sweetness, but I sure did like the effect. There was no argument with the effect from the get-go. Because all of a sudden, after a couple of these, drinking them all the way down, they were getting warmer, I didn't care, I kept drinking them. A couple of my buddies peeled off. Didn't recognize that as a symptom, but it soon would become a pattern in my life. People would drop away from me in terms of amounts and frequency of consumption. But all of a sudden I started to feel great. And little by slowly, those fears and an inferiority started to drift away, somehow, some way. And I felt okay. And I felt okay for probably the first time in a real long time. And I felt okay because I was having a beer. I wasn't doing anything illegal. We didn't stick up the deli. We didn't steal a car. We just had a couple of beers. Socially acceptable? Absolutely. It wasn't on Staten Island. It was never a question of if we were going to drink, but when we were going to get started. It was a real big Irish alcoholic component to Staten Island living. There's a street called Forest Avenue. It's supposed to have 62 bars. A lot of you guys from Jersey would come over late at night and steal our women when we were too drunk to notice. But you guys that lived in Bayonne and that part of Jersey used to come over because you couldn't drink it until you were 21, I believe. But they call it Peter Pan Alley because it's the street where guys never grow up, where little boys never grow up. And it's still true to this day because if I went to Duffy's Tavern tomorrow, A, my seat at the bar would still be there. Duffy would still be behind the bar. And a lot of these guys would still be there, you know, waiting for Wendy, waiting to grow up. And it wasn't going to happen. So I became real attached to this feeling of alcohol. I didn't really know what was happening, but I became really attached to the feeling that the alcohol was doing for me. I really liked what it did for me. It made me very popular. I thought it made me really smooth with the ladies. I thought it made me an exceptional dancer. The other thing it did do was the first couple times is it made me violently ill. I got real, real sick from drinking. And I did what the body reacted the way the body should when you put mass quantities of a substance that's a little bit poisonous to us. You're drinking a lot of it quick, it repelled it. The body did what it's supposed to do. It repelled it out of the body. It said no more. And I'm trying to drink more, and it's going out, you know, I'm drinking it one way, and it's going out the other way. But I wanted to keep the feeling going. The body said, we can't process this. It has to go. So I would confess this. You know, that was not a sign of manly drinking. I remember that. That was like not done, you know. And I confessed that, and I was told that I didn't do it right. I didn't prepare. What did you have for dinner? I said, well, I don't know. Chinese? No, that was it. He said, really? He said, yeah, you need something with cream. You need a good base. Next time we go. I said, okay. Following my friend's lead, whose brother was a stone cold drinker and knew all the ropes. So I said, okay, don't worry. Next Friday, I'm in. I got this, you know, cream of mushroom soup, milk, ice cream, whatever. I'm there. Let me get this right. And that was another thing that was another pattern in my life for the next 28 or so years. This overwhelming desire to get this right. To get this down, get this, make this happen for me, make this go well, be able to drink successfully. And I could never seem to quite do it. It didn't stop me from trying. You know, the book calls it a drinking career, and I love that turn of phrase because it was certainly like a career. I mean, I don't know if he's tongue-in-cheek when he says to characterize our drinking careers, but for me it was a career. It's like I punched the clock in the alcoholic land. I just punched the time clock and I said, all right, let's go to work. The whistle blows and let's start drinking. And we drank like it was a job. I mean, I drank nonstop, seriously. I studied booze and alcohol. I knew what wine went with what food. And I knew what in the summertime you switched over to the clears. And in the fall you went to the ambers and the scotches. And I knew all the combinations of food and alcohol. Because this all surrounded and gave me the delusion of some sort of a bon vivant, some sort of a good liver. Not liver, but good liver. You know, a liver of life. That I was some sort of a man about town, that I knew my stuff about booze. And I celebrated all that. And I was the guy, and you come over to my house and there'd be mass quantities of alcohol. And there'd be good alcohol, and there'd be my alcohol, and then there'd be stuff I would serve you, and you better not have mine. And you know, I had a real possessive attitude towards booze right from the get-go. I needed booze to survive, to continue. I couldn't see any of these truths. A lot of them are described right in the beginning of the book. Those pages I skipped over in the doctor's opinion. A lot of the truths were revealed to me once I had a teacher, someone that would show me. But I was convinced that I was some kind of a grandiose connoisseur, gourmet, that I knew all the right combinations of food and drink, and I knew how to have a good time, and I knew when I went out places, I knew how to have a good time. I would bring a case of beer, some obscure brand, microbrew. So if I saw you having one across the room, I would know that somehow you had found your way into my stash. Most times I would just sit on the cooler that I bought so that you wouldn't be able to. That's social drinking, right? I'm sorry, you can't identify, but I would sit or stand, you know, like, so I knew I had that stash, you know, and like, I would make a beer run with like 8 in the cooler, you know, that's when we were hitting that dangerous area. Forget about running out. That meant either call the guy in the beeper or something else was happening real quick, because if we were out, that was a problem. That was no good at all. But I mean, I'm looking at that last layer of beer and ice and it's time for the next run, because on that run we might run into a few people who had some other stuff that we wanted and we could go do that. But that was my life. That's how I lived every day of my life. I mean, if every day of my life was just consumed with mass quantities of alcohol. I remember seeing the Coneheads and I used to laugh, you know, six, you know, right down. I'm like, if I could have done that, I would have done that. But the quorum told me that I had to drink six real quick. I couldn't drink six at once. And, you know, so many telltale signs were there, but I couldn't see them because I didn't want to see them. I was in absolute denial. But looking back through the lens of recovery, looking back through a recovered mind and a recovered spirit, I mean, how many people drink before they go out drinking? You know, I would have a big, tall Johnny Walker Black on the rocks before I went to your house to drink. I mean, this is obscure behavior. That's just not normal behavior. That's not sound thinking, or certainly it's not sound drinking. And, you know, again, I had this lie that I didn't have a problem with alcohol. The problem would be if I would run out. Lo and behold, I would run out. But my problem, I thought, was just that there would not be enough alcohol for me to get by. I didn't see for many, many a day how dependent I was on alcohol. And it wasn't until the alcohol was removed and I was able to look back and do some writing assignments, and certainly with the wisdom of this book, and see how twisted my mind was about alcohol, how I would willingly give my whole paycheck every weekend. It wouldn't matter. It wouldn't matter to me if I didn't come home with any money. If I got paid on a Thursday, I didn't have any. That didn't matter as long as I had enough stuff to get me through the weekend. And I didn't want to run out. I was always afraid of running out. So then this ATM machines were just coming into vogue, and those were like wonderful. I couldn't believe it. Like, wow, money right here is at the drop of a hat, you know, until the money ran out. And then my only indication that I was suffering from this, from any kind of problem, was that I was running out of money real quick. I was tapped out much earlier than anybody else was tapped out. I don't know if anybody else got paid on a Thursday and came home with no money on a Friday, but I had a story that I would tell my wife about. Oh, you can't believe what happened this week. You're not going to believe it. You know, the guys, the this, the that, the union, you know, I had all these stories and manifestations why I didn't have any money, why I never had any money. But I was convinced that I really just had a financial problem, that I just wasn't making enough money to underwrite this lifestyle. And, you know, one thing led to another, and, you know, as any really good party will do, it ends, you know, and it ended kind of abruptly for me. It ended, I hit a financial bottom, and I hit a bottom in my life, in my lifestyle, where I was doing things that were, if not unscrupulous, certainly illegal, and to keep this money going, because again, as I said, I was a compulsive gambler, and I also a cocaine user. I wasn't an addict. That was explained to me down the road a little bit. I would never introduce myself as an alcoholic and addict, but I thought I was an addict, but cocaine and gambling are expensive hobbies. Can I just cut to the chase? They cost. Picture like cross country skiing, like ballooning, like hot air ballooning, they're very expensive pastimes. And when those pastimes get out of control, you don't have any money. And then you do things to get money, and you lie about the things you did to get money, and you lie where the money went, and all these schemes and dreams around the gambling was going to pay for this. You know, my life came to a screeching halt. The party came to a screeching halt. And for me, it didn't come in a detox or a rehab. It came as a result of this financial unmanageability crisis, where it came to me very clearly that I needed to get some help. And if I could convince some people, I can't even say it now, if I could convince people that I had a drinking problem, that they couldn't fire me for all my financial indiscretions. That's the real quick version. And somehow convince these people, but I'm understanding now, or recently, that was the hand of God protecting me and saving me from certain death at my own hands with alcohol and cocaine. I was overweight, I was getting, you know, I was using more substances than I could probably safely tolerate. My body was really taking a beating at my own hands. And it was like a slow, deliberate form of suicide I was engaged in. But God intervened. And God, you know, not only does God not make any junk, but God doesn't want to see his stuff treated like junk. And I was treating his stuff, his body, his mind, his spirit, like junk. I was trashing his creation. And he didn't want to see that anymore, and he intervened. and the loving hand of God well before I take the second step. God doesn't enter my life when I make that decision about He's everything or He's nothing. If I'm reading those pages, He's already everything. If I'm in this book, if I'm reading, if I have this book in front of me, He's already pretty active in my life. Let me tell you, that's my experience. But He, God intervenes and sets me on this narrow, narrow path and uses this very small window of opportunity, and it's called God's grace. He takes this very small window of time that was given to Him, and He pushes me through the door, away from a life and towards another life. Now, I'm in limbo, you know, because I'm not in that other life yet. I'm still, you know, they say when one door closes, the other door opens, but the hallways are a bitch, you know. I'm in this long hallway with the door closed behind me and only a door with a circle and a triangle in front of me. And I don't want to go in that door. I don't know anything about AA, but I know that when I go through that door, my life is over, officially. Done. It's kaput. My life, as I know it, is over. Once I enter that realm, from even the anecdotal information I knew about it, that I was a goner. I was a done deal. I went home. I told my wife, I says, this is it. You know, I said, I'm not going to be any fun anymore. We're not going to get invited to any places anymore. Our life is over. But, you know, what foolish words. You know, it's so obvious now that my life was just beginning. And I cursed my alcoholism, and I cursed my genetics, and I cursed everything about my alcoholism, but it was the best thing that ever happened to me. People do a workshop called The Gift of Alcoholism, you know? And I had a hard time seeing the truth of that. But I would have never been introduced to the spiritual way of life without the disease of alcoholism. So I go through that narrow opening, go through that narrow doorway, and I begin to see what's on the other side of the door, and it's the fellowship of AA. And that's what's waiting for me on the other side of that door. And I remember having to go to an outpatient rehab, and I had to go there 3 nights a week, and I had to go to 3 12-step meetings a week. And I called the counselor aside. I said, you know, did I hear right? I said, that's 6 nights. I said, that's every night, right? I said, I work, I have a life, I'm busy. And he said to me, Charlie, he said, how many nights a week did you drink? And I said, oh, I get it. Where do I sign? And I had to sign a consent form. That was how I was going to get my job back, was to go get these attendance sheets signed at AA meetings, which is I always have a special place, at least in my time or my moment, for anybody who's out there getting these things signed, because that's how I came through the doorways, having to get attendance form signed at AA meetings, NA meetings, any other kind of meetings you could go to. I went to NA. That was my very first 12-step meeting. I didn't really... A lot of bikers, a lot of cigarette smoking, a lot of hugging. I got the keychain. You know, I still got a bunch of the keychains, but I didn't really get it. I didn't really hear what I was... I didn't hear anything solid. But next night I went to AA meeting in Westfield, and I couldn't quite get myself to go into the meeting. I couldn't bring myself to attend the meeting. I didn't want to go. You know, I didn't want to go. Maybe I knew what was going to happen when I got there, but I didn't want to go. And I didn't want to get out of the car. And something moved me to get out of the car and approach this crowd of happy people, just like the crowd out there, just like the crowd in the kitchen, happy, joyous, and free people talking and laughing amongst themselves about the issues of the day. It was springtime, it was April, people were talking about things that I was really passionate about, gardening, baseball, getting golf clubs out, and I was like, wow, maybe one of these guys knows where AA is, you know? So I asked them, I said, can you tell me where the AA meeting is? And they looked at me and they said, well, it's right here. And I said, oh, cool. I said, that's good. What a coincidence. And then they pushed me in the door, and I saw those guys begin to file into the room and take the seats. And I didn't expect to see people like that in AA. I didn't expect to see smiling, gregarious people living lives and talking and driving cars. I didn't expect to see that at all. I don't know what I expected, but it wasn't that. And I sat through my first AA meeting, and a gentleman came up to me afterwards, and he shook my hand and looked me directly in the eye, and he says, let me tell you, pal, it gets better. And I was like, oh, why did he have to say that? You know, it was cool. I had cookies and coffee, and there was a good-looking woman there. And why did he have to blow that whole night with that? And I was like, how could you do that to me? Like, I said, bro, you don't know that. I'm thinking to myself, you know, it ain't going to get any better. And I just called home. I told him it couldn't get any worse, and now you're going to tell me it's getting better. This is the end for me. I'm off. I've come off the social register. My life is over. And here he tells me it's getting better. It's going to get better. And I see this gentleman around a lot. His name is Harry, and I always mention that to him. And everybody knew it was my first meeting, and I didn't know how they knew it was my first meeting. I mean, I was ignorant enough to... I wanted to ask people, what did you guys do last week? Like, I thought AA started that night. Like, in what happened last week? What did you guys do? Watch TV or, you know? But I didn't get it, and it was a long time before I got it. And I did what I heard, which was don't drink and go to meetings, which is great instructions, you know, for the body. That's one side of the triangle. That's the great instructions for me, for my body. Get myself to an AA meeting. But it's a triangle. It's three sides. And you can't just pursue one side. But that's what I did for 3.5 years. And I've kind of been very passionate about devoting myself to no one else doing that. That I meet. If I meet someone in a meeting or I see a newcomer, I'm determined that that's not going to be their path. And groups like this are determined and that's not going to be the path when somebody walks in and it's 90 days or getting something signed. So we don't do that. But I went for 3.5 years in at one side of the triangle and living the fellowship life and doing the fellowship deal, and service to me was making a pot of coffee, and I didn't get, you don't know what you don't know, right? So I don't know. But then I get the message of Alcoholics Anonymous as described in this big book. I get that because I go to a meeting through another set of circumstances where God is imminently involved. Gets me to go to the meeting where everybody told me not to go. Don't go up the hill to Berkeley Heights. Don't go up there. They're going to ruin you. I'm thinking, wow, if these guys think they're going to ruin me, you know, and I heard all the warning, you know, and I drive up there because I knew this wasn't working. I was 3.5 years abstinent, and I was miserable inside. I was torn up inside. I was still gambling. I was still doing a lot of other things that weren't changing my sobriety date in either of those two fellowships, AA or NA. I was clean, but I was not sober. I was abstinent, but I was not sane. And I went up the hill to this group, and it was a different kind of AA. It was a whole different thing was happening up there than was happening where I came from. Even the bumper stickers, you know, the big book says it, I believe it. So, you know, all these, like, big book, it was like a whole big book culture up there. And I just didn't get it. I didn't get it. My book was just the same way as the same day I bought it. I flipped through it a couple times, and it was right up on my little AA shrine with my 12 and 12 and my big book and a little, maybe like a Hazelden meditation book on top of that. I kept that at home, so, you know, everybody at home would know that I'm an AA, you know, I'm AA bound, you know, don't worry about me. Just dust it off from time to time. But wow, you talk about appearance sake. When I got up to that meeting and I saw these people's books, I wanted to say, what happened to your book? Guys' books were held together with duct tape. Guys' books were like colored in with all, I said, who did that to your book? How'd you let someone do that? Write in the margins and color it all. You don't write in books. You know, you don't write in books. That's how I was brought up. Underlines and writing in margins and yellow highlighters and orange highlighters and green highlighters and highlighters on the highlighters and stickers and bookmarks. And I was like, geez, this is kind of weird. People quoting the book without even opening up the book. And on page 21, and I'm like, wow, this is cool. Like, the guy knows the whole book. It was a whole different world of AA. My wife said it was like college. Like, the other AA that I was going to was something else. This was like a college course in AA. And boy, did I need a college course in AA. And did I need what these people were talking about. You know, did I really needed the solution. I needed the 12 steps of my life so desperately. And it came, and I was so open and so willing, it didn't matter what they told me to do, I was going to do it. I couldn't go back down that hallway. I couldn't go the other way. I was just rigidly, stubbornly determined not to drink again. That was all I had going for me. No solution, no spirit, no prayer. No meditation, no kind of prayer life at all. And I walked into this meeting and I followed instructions and I sought out someone who I thought had the solution. You know, I thought the solution was almost imprinted on this gentleman. When I was out there using, I didn't want to go to the guy you copped from, I wanted to go to the guy he copped from. You know what I'm saying? I wanted to go upline a few steps always. That's how I was with my solution. And it was, again, God's grace. I don't want to know who you got it. I don't want to go to you. Who did you get it from? Let me go to him, and up, and up, and up. And then I got the guy who was kind of the head honcho in the room. And I that's how I was driven. And boy, this guy leveled me in so many ways, in so many areas of my life. He was able to pull the covers right off me. You know, nobody likes that. You know, you're warm and you're snuggled up, and you might be sleeping in a crappy cot or an army cot, but when someone pulls the covers off you, that makes it just that much worse. And that's how I felt. He just pulled the covers off my lame-ass recovery, my don't drink and go to meetings lifestyle, my sick and suffering and twisted spirit. He just pulled the covers right off me and exposed me just for what I was a sick and twisted alcoholic with no solution. You know, I hadn't heard the words untreated alcoholism as of yet. I would not hear them for many a year. I hear them a lot now, but that's what I was. Still restless, still irritable, still discontent, just no drink. Took the drink away, put the drink down, everything else is status quo. And this guy begins to lead me and begins to direct me. And we begin to have some beginning attempts at these steps. And I'm seeing words in this book, and this book is starting to come alive in a way that I didn't think possible. You know, the doctor's opinion had great meaning to me all of a sudden. We drink because we like the effect. I didn't really get that. I said, well, I don't know whether I drink because I like the effect. And then I thought, and I wondered about that, and I puzzled about that, and I made a substitution in my head. If I was to drink now, I would drink an Arizona iced tea, perhaps, if I'm thirsty. But would I sit and would I drink 12 Arizona iced teas? Would I watch a ball game with a case of Arizona iced tea? Would I get to your house and say, "Who's got the Arizona? Fill it up." You know, no. I wasn't having that react because Arizona iced tea doesn't do anything for me. It does what a beverage is supposed to do. It quenches my thirst. Try to drink 6 of them. You'll get sick. Try to drink 12 Dr. Peppers and see what happens. You'll get sick. You won't like it. You won't make it to 12. You won't be able to sit and watch 2 football games and drink 12 Dr. Peppers. It just won't happen. Heineken, different story. Maybe some Black Zimbuka at halftime, you know. You get the picture. This stuff is having an effect on me, an immediate and direct effect. Now I see it. Now I can see the truth. Johnny Walker Black, it doesn't have an effect. I'm done with it. It's expensive, you know, and it doesn't taste so great. But boy, did it kick my ass, and it took me right where I needed to go. Every time, the book says at once. You didn't have to drink a Johnny Walker Black and sit around and wait. You know, you were right there. You know, Duff, can I have another one? Boom, you know. And the other guy's saying, well, I said, what's up with you? And he's like stirring a glass, you know. This is a non-alcoholic that I've been saddled with for that particular evening. And he's stirring with the straw. And I'm like, what is the straw even for? I don't even know where to do this. I could have had one straw for the whole 28 years of drinking, let me tell you. That's all I would have needed. I could have kept it in my back pocket and we could have bronzed it today. But I'm like, what are you doing? What are you stirring that for? Well, I'm starting to feel it. I'm like, yes, thank you. We're going to feel it. We're going to move forward. Let's get our, you know, let's get your stuff together, get your marching orders. We're getting out of here. Are you feeling, you know? No, he says, I think it's time to go home. But, you know, I was, from the get-go, I was drinking because I liked the effect, and that effect took me places where the resistance is down. I got more effects, and I liked those even more. But, wow, the truth was revealed to me in this book. And now I can measure my experience by this book. And I can see how I was different. I'm in a separate class. I'm having a reaction that most of the public's not having to booze. My wife doesn't have that reaction. We go out to a restaurant, she brings a bottle of wine, she has 2 glasses, she says, can you put the cork back in it? I said, the cork's not meant to go back in. You know, you don't put corks back in bottles, but we put the cork back in so we can go to the Chinese restaurant next week with the same wine bottle. Not my experience. I don't have 2 glasses of wine with dinner. I tried, but I can't. I'm an alcoholic. I'm in a distinct entity. We go to descriptions of the alcoholic. I'm led to that, and I see that. We go to Bill's story. All of a sudden, Bill's story comes alive. Just with this other guy's input and influence. And I see, he says that curious alloy of drink and speculation. And that's me, drunk at Belmont Park Racetrack. You know, it's him, and it's me. It's all right there. Barbiturates. I mean, my story is all of a sudden unfolding in ways that I couldn't imagine. Alcohol was my master. I saw that. I didn't see that before, but I saw it then. It was my master. It controlled me. I didn't see that. I gave it permission mentally. The mind gives the body permission to do what's going to kill it, but I didn't see it until I saw it here. And then it became abundantly clear, I think is the term. And the way I was, all my untruths, all my lies about the way I was living, you know, if you were me, you would drink too. Situations at home were made clear through the efforts of the fourth and the fifth step. Writing inventory of my parents. I didn't want to do that. I mean, column 1 and column 2, I was rock solid with. You know, all the things they did to me, that was tremendously cleansing. You know, I wrote this, you know, huge inventory of my parents. And coming to the third column, areas that were affected and putting the brakes on a little bit, but certainly losing full interest when it came to column 4, which was what was my part. Because I couldn't see it. I saw things that were done to me, and if you were me, you would drink too, and poor me, and I saw myself as a victim. I used that word at the beginning, not a Freudian slip, but that's how I felt about myself, that I was a victim of these two people, that they had set out with a deliberate plan to ruin me. And I almost, you know, but then the truth was revealed. That's a lie. Here comes the truth. I confessed to this gentleman in his house. We opened up a discussion, and I brought these two people to the fore, and I explained all the nasty, horrible things that had been done to me, and I said, I don't have anything in, you know, for my part. I had measly scribbles, That's it. I didn't really have a fourth column on my folks. And he said, Charlie, he said, they did the best they could with the tools they were given. Let's move on. And I felt this thing like fall from me, but I didn't want it to fall from me, so I put it back on. I said, no, wait a minute, we're paying attention. I don't think you've been listening so far. I'm thinking to myself, this guy's supposed to be so good, he can't even, he's even stumped by this. And I said, you're not listening. Do you hear what they did? I said, my dad walked out and he said, Charlie. He said, it's done. He said, it's over with. Today is now. They did the best job they could with the tools they were given. He said it again. And I couldn't wrap myself around that concept. I really struggled with that. And he had a discussion about that my mom was one of us. He said, you said your mom was one of us. He said, I've seen you at a meeting. He said, if your mom walked in a room, he said, you'd be the first one over to make sure she had a cup of coffee and a place to sit. And you'd hook her up with some woman in the room. He says, all of a sudden now you're standing in judge and jury over your mother. He says, you're presiding with a whole case against your mother. He says, I don't see that. And I could see a little bit of truth in that statement, because that would probably happen if she came in as a stranger, but not if she came in as my mom. And he said, your dad did the best he could, and he had to leave. He was in a situation, and he had to go. He said, that's done. And it was done. And it was one of the coolest things that ever happened to me. And it happened because I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. It happened to me because I said my life was over. And that day, my life just started to begin. You know, because now I didn't walk around with the resentments against your parents. You can't live a successful life resenting the two people that brought you into this earth. That's not a recipe for success. It's a recipe for disaster, drinking or not, alcoholic or not. It just can't be. It's against every shred of human nature, every shred of decency, every shred of God's love that's been put in your body to turn against your parents like that. And here, Alcoholics Anonymous, this professional loser society that I perceived it to be, straightened me out for $1 a week. Come on. Who's better than that? You know, I don't know about that. I don't know what have ever reached the root of that problem. And then we discussed why I didn't have anything in the fourth column, and we discussed this to great lengths. And he said, Charlie, he said, when did this all happen? I said, oh, gee, man, I said, this must have been like, and I caught myself, because I said, it must have been over 30 years ago. He said, you're acting like it happened last weekend. He said, you're keeping the resentment alive. He said, your dad is dead and buried. He said, he's not keeping the resentment alive, you are. And he said, your mom is over on Staten Island by herself in a nursing home. She's not keeping this resentment alive today, you are. You're feeding, you're fanning it, you're nurturing it, you're helping it grow. Every day you feed it a little more, you keep it like you keep an African violet in a window. I keep it specially fed, specially watered. I want it to bloom and flourish because it gave me fuel to be who I was and do what I did, even here in AA. But having this discussion with this gentleman and having that lifted from me was just one of the most liberating things that's ever happened to me. And boy, I tell you, the rest of my inventory went like that. You know, like I share often, the guy that mows the lawn Sunday morning, all of a sudden, didn't really matter, you know. After my mom and my dad, you know, the guy that parks a little too close to me at work, no big deal. He could park right on top of my car. Now, I really don't care, pal. I'm okay. You know, you could just put your car on my lawn if you like today. I'm good to go. Like, and so the book says we take the book down from the shelf and we take the hour, but he took me up to the Shrine of St. Joseph for an hour and sat me down, and we were driving around, and he was telling me stuff, and I didn't see it at the time. He showed me these big trees, and he said, wow. He said, what kind of a root system do you think a tree like that must have to stand and weather all these storms? I was like, when did this become like nature, like a nature show? I'm like, I don't know, pretty deep, I guess. And so, but I'm still like, my heart's going like this. And he sits me down in a pew and he leaves me there for an hour. Sit, review the first five proposals. Did you leave anything out? What do we need to do now? Anything we need to talk about? Gave me direct and precise instructions for 6 and 7. He was writing while I was talking. He had a list of my character defects, of which I didn't think I had many. I had a lot. Back in the day, I thought my only character defect was drinking too much. And I thought by stopping drinking, I was done with character defects. And when I read the shades on the wall, I thought they were good for you guys, but certainly didn't apply to me. All my character defects are there. He gives me the opposites. He gives me a prayer for the morning. God, please, please remove my dishonesty and give me the strength to replace it with honesty. God removes. I practice the opposite. God removes. I practice the opposite. I don't remove. I'm out of the equation. God does. God's been doing for me the whole time. Understand? God's been doing for me since I got the very notion of this solution. God's been doing for me, and He continues to do for me. So He removes my defects. I don't work in partnership with Him. I don't help Him. I don't even know really clearly what my defects are on a given day. I know that if it's not taking me towards God, if it's taking me to the opposite, then I'm in trouble. If it's full of self, and if it's not full of God, you know, where's God in all this? This is all I have to ask myself. Where am I? Or I could ask myself, where am I in the triangle? And then we go and we make a list of the people that I have harmed, because He was writing little H's in circles as I was doing my inventory. So my eighth step was done, just like the book says it'll be done. And I went out and I began to make amends. And I made an amend at the gravesite to my dad, and I left my 1-year coin on his tombstone. And that was the best I could do, because he wasn't there. He never saw me sober. It was tough for me to live with that for a while, but I know that he sees me soberly now, and I know that he comes with me when I do these speaking gigs, and I know he's part of everything I do. I made amends to my mom, and I tried to get to the, and she cut me off. She said, "Whatever, just do what you've been doing. Keep doing what you've been doing." And she could see the difference in me, and we moved forward in that path, and I began to look at step 10 and how I could use these tools on a daily basis, continue in the way the book talks about. And I began a halting attempt at step 11, prayer and meditation. You know, start with real baby steps. You know, prayer is talking to God, meditation is listening. That's a great place to start. It's a mere beginning. Did I agree? Did I make that promise in the book? Do I agree to grow and develop along spiritual lines? So we have to start somewhere. I have to start with a real childish conception about this stuff. That's where I'm at. I'm like a child trapped in a 44-year-old body. I don't know where to start. I can't start up on a mountaintop with the guru. I start somewhere. And I'm getting introduced to real basic meditation practices. Very, very basic. Stillness, quiet, focus. Set the microwave timer in the kitchen for 3 minutes, 2 minutes, 1 minute. Start. Begin. Start somewhere. Next day, maybe 3.5. Make a beginning. Try it. It's a discipline. It's meditation practice, not meditation perfect. It says God will discipline us in this way we've outlined. I don't discipline, God does. Do I need discipline? Hell yeah. I need a boatload of discipline. Let me tell you. Sober, recovered, I still need, you know, I require God's discipline in my life. I'm guilty of wanting to turn away from the things that brought me here. When things go bad, what's the first thing to go? 10 and 11. I ain't going to meditate today. I don't feel good. I'm all distracted. I can't meditate today. It's too cold. It's too hot. I'm too tired. I'm too awake. It's too early. It's too late. The mind, the ego, you know, wants to bring me away from that. Maybe to a drink, but certainly not to God. So when I hear those, as soon as I engage in that dialogue, I know I'm done. But where do I go? I have to go to God. I have to bring these things to God and to quiet and try to listen to God's directions, the three places in the book, at night, first thing in the morning, and throughout the day. What am I doing in those areas? I can't get sober on last year's meditation. I can't get sober on the prayers I made 4 days ago, 5 days ago, 7 days ago. I'm not that same person. Working with others. I used to think making coffee was 12-step work. You know, every AA meeting I've come to, I wanted to have a cup of coffee. Wouldn't it be nice if I made coffee once or twice? Every AA meeting I came to, I wanted a place to sit. Wouldn't it be nice if I helped with the chairs? That's just common courtesy, folks. The work is described in this book is working with another alcoholic through these 12 steps, taking somebody through in this work, doing what was so freely given to me. Like that guy gave up his time and his house and his heart to me. And as I kept on thanking him and thanking him and thanking him, he said, "Stop thanking me. Just do this with the next person that asks." And I did. And I keep doing that. And we keep doing that. And we're blessed to have this peace, this quiet, these surroundings. The chaos is out there. We invite quiet in, we invite God in, and we do the deal. You know, and I'm really, truly blessed. No matter what happens on a day-to-day basis in my life, I'm really, truly blessed. I'm so grateful to be a member of this fellowship and to be a recovered alcoholic and to be active in this program. My gratitude really knows no bounds. And I think at this point we stop and we turn it over to some questions, but I want to thank you guys for listening, and